accession number 18822, reel 17.
Reel
17. With self-government, full self-government arrived in 1960, and to my astonishment, a lot of my more intelligent friends immediately resigned, took their redundancy pay and their accrued pensions, and left to start a new career, somewhere, anywhere. I couldn't understand this, because the Muslims had begged us to stay, because if we left, the only people with paper qualifications to take our places was those damned mission-educated Ibos from southeast Nigeria, whom the Muslims loathed and abominated. A typical case would be there was the post of assistant vet in an area. I knew the vet officer quite well, and there were two candidates were being considered. One was a northern Nigerian whose father owned 200 head of cattle and would have been the perfect assistant vet. He'd been born and brought up with cattle. He knew exactly what to do. If, say, rinderpest broke out, he'd see it very quickly, and he could get the infected animals away and slaughtered and buried, and the rest of the herd would be safe. And he just knew exactly how to treat a cow. And the other candidate was an Igbo who came from a Tsetse area who had never even seen a cow, a head of cattle. And the awful thing was that by using rapid results, learn our model answers by heart, the Igbo got more marks on the written paper and by all rights should have been given the job. But the vet officer, provincial vet officer, thought the hell with this, and he appointed the northerner, which was a good thing. But the Igbo went back to his own country and spoke to his senior brother. Now, the Igbos are in tribal groups, and each tribal group has what is translated as a senior brother, and that's a chap who's educated, clued up, streetwise, and by common consent, the most able chap in that tribal group. And the senior brother knew what to do. He managed to get a letter to a politician called Fenner Brockway. And Fenner Brockway briefed a Labour MP, and a parliamentary question was asked. And then, I don't know who was colonial officer at the time, but he wrote to the federal governor at Lagos, who in turn wrote to the regional governor in Kaduna, who in turn wrote to the resident in Bornu, who in turn wrote to the senior district officer in Bu, at each stage, copies of the letters were sent to the federal chief veterinary officer, regional chief veterinary officer, provincial veterinary officer, and the chap who'd made the appointment of the northerner was asked in this letter to explain in writing the circumstances under which he had appointed Abu Bakr Bornu when Mr. Enugu had gained more marks on the written paper for the appointment. And that was a bit of a facer. The end was that the northerner was dismissed and the Igbo was put in his place, but the Igbo failed to recognize incipient rinderpest, and whole herds of cattle were not treated and just got the disease and had to be slaughtered. And he hadn't a clue. All he had behind him was reference results, learn our model answers by heart. However, everybody was happy because Fenner Brockway, the Labour MP, and the Labour MP felt in a vague sort of way they had done the right thing and redressed a wrong. And one may be sorry about rinderpest and so on, but there it is. You couldn't go around undemocratically appointing whoever you liked. So there was even an undertone of a suggestion that the vet officer, the British vet officer, and Abu Bakr Bornu perhaps had a homosexual relationship. Who knows? Why was this appointment made, etc.? So it was all rather nasty, all rather silly, but it was the kind of thing that did happen. Well, there was a massive handover on the 1st of October 1960. The Nigerians were really very reasonable. They said there would be riots if they weren't made independent on the 1st of April 1960. But when it was explained that April was the hottest time of the year, it would be difficult to arrange suitable festivities. And I think somebody came out representing the Queen by April, but it could be done by October, and they cheerfully said, all right, let's make it October. So they were in the mood to be, the Nigerians were in the mood to be cooperative, and the northern region, we thought it was the ideal handover. There was £2 million regional balance, which would be £50 million a day, quite a lot of money for a region. But sadly, the northern politicians just fretted the money away. They built a most expensive hotel, and it was really rather pleasant to have it there. You could go into an air-conditioned dining room and have a five-course meal if you had the money. And outside, they built a 50-metre Olympic-sized swimming pool. And this cost a fortune, and only the Brits and the expatriates used it. Nigerians either had never learned to swim, or B, were never going to strip down to a pair of bathing trunks to go in. So there was a very expensive swimming pool, using up the reserve funds we'd handed over to them on self-government, and an expensive air-conditioned hotel. And then, worse than that, the senior northerner, Alhaji Amadou Sardana Sokoto, insisted that there was suitable in Sokoto, it was suitable to make cement. It's quite true. You could make cement in Sokoto reasonably cheaply because the raw materials were there all over the place. But from Sokoto, it was nearly 700 miles down to Lagos, or 400 miles to the southern boundary of the region, and it was hopeless to make cement there because the transport cost of sending it hundreds of miles nullified it. I mean, by the time you paid for the machinery, got it up to Sokoto, manufactured the cement, I don't know how one does that, but anyway, however one does it, and then sent the cement miles down to wherever it was needed, you could buy it more cheaply from Europe. And a federal committee solemnly, I think, got a note or two notes wrong, and to every astonishment, 27 ships arrived in Lagos Harbour, every single one of them bung full of cement. But nobody knew what to do with it. I mean, I think one or two ships were unloaded and this cement used. But 27 ocean-going cardboard vessels, absolutely bung full of cement, were no use to man nor beast. And they stayed in Lagos Harbour, clogging up the space, while the cement deteriorated in the sea air, and became unusable, and there were, for months or even a year or two, there were fierce arguments with insurers and so on. Meanwhile, nothing was done. The ships had just left there, while the independent Nigerian committee that had made this decision or ordered this cement and made this howling error by getting a note or two wrong tried to foist it off on their insurers, and it was just absolutely chaotic. At the same time, there were reserve funds which had been invested by Crown agents in equities, and the Sardana ordered sell the lot and have the cash brought back to Nigeria, to Northern Nigeria, where we will use it for whatever we think fit. And they explained that the market had dropped a bit and they were worth less than their purchase price, but it was every hope that if you hung on till around April or May, one would be able to sell at a slight profit. But he said, sell now! So, anyway, they made a loss. So, on the one hand, the Muslims were good to me personally. They said, we will not have you superseded by the emir's nephew. We will give you your extremely generous accrued leave, awarded a leave ratio awarded by Lord Lugard in the early 1900s, whereas things have changed, and none of the commercial firms in the tropics gives that ratio of leave anymore, but we'll stand by it. And they did, they were as good as their words. And 6 whole years went by, and we had 3 fabulous leaves, one on the south coast of Turkey and Istanbul, and each time we went on leave, we would buy, drop at either Frankfurt or Stuttgart and buy a German car. The best I ever bought was a Mercedes. And we would use it the whole of that leave, and we drove down the Romanchester Strasse into northern Italy and to Ferrovia and Venice and across to Siena and Tuscany, and had a whale of a time. Or we would try Spain, and with a Mercedes to play with, it was all absolutely fabulous. And when I finally got that car shipped with us to Nigeria, I was able to sell it for more than I'd paid for it. So I couldn't think why my more intelligent friends had all quietly resigned when this kind of lifestyle was going begging. And one day in January 1966, about 6 years after self-government, at 2 o'clock in the morning, I was woken up by gunfire, the sound of gunfire. And I said to Angela, these military maneuvers are really getting far too realistic. I'm going to complain to the brigadier. When I got down to the office at 7 o'clock, we always worked 7 till 9, break for breakfast, 9 till 2:30, and then by that time it was so hot we called it a day. At 7 o'clock I got there, and to my astonishment, Nothing was swept, cleaned or tidied. The files hadn't been moved from the out trays to where they should have been moved to. And the messengers were all gibbering in a corner, saying that there had been a military revolution and the Sardana had been assassinated, and his senior wife were among those killed. There were about 9 or 10 others killed in the crossfire, security officers, guards and sentries and the like. And I said, "Gakaria Banza, rubbish. Shigemoto, get into the car." And I took the head messenger and we drove down to the Sardana's residence. He was Alhaji Amadou Bello, Sardana of Sokoto, regional premier of northern Nigeria. And I said, there was the great big white security wall, absolutely intact. I said, "To Agashi Goma." And the messenger looked at it and said, "Gabayanchi, go and look round the other side of the security wall." So I got out of the car, and goes, to my astonishment, the Sardana's imposing residence was a smoking ruin. It had just been burned to the ground. So I got back into the car, thinking furiously, drove back to my office and rang my wife and said, "Darling, there's been a revolution." And she said, "Saturday morning is the only morning I don't have to get early up early and teach. I'm not having you pester me with this kind of practical joke," and slams the receiver down. It was for real. The surprise among the expatriates and the Brits was absolutely complete. Nobody expected this. We were totally taken off balance. The American vice consul had gone on leave to Dahomey, and on the day of the revolution, he was trying to get through customs back to Nigeria, and he was held up at the border point at his own expense in some thoroughly unsatisfactory accommodation for 3 whole weeks, unable to get back to his job. And the other American, who was generally agreed by all of us to be the chap who reported to CIA, he had status and title either deputy consul or assistant consul or something like that, or vice consul. But we all, it was generally agreed that he was the man that reported whatever was going on to the CIA. He'd spent the evening in, of all things, the Nigeria officer's mess, having a sort of a drinks party, and hadn't a clue. And it turned out that a major called Unzoku, who was an Igbo, had got together 2 lorry loads of non-Hausa troops and attacked and killed the premier, assassinated, and taken over. We had over breakfast, I managed to turn on the television, and there was a sweating continuity announcer looking as scared as hell, saying that Nigeria was now ruled by a revolutionary military government following a successful coup, and that a whole list of things would be punishable by death. This included defacing of public notices and indulging in homosexuality. It was just something must have been dreamed up by Major Nzoku, which sounded very odd on television, but there was no doubt about the menace. The Muslims went into a kind of massive sulk. They put up with Igbos running the northern Nigeria for them. They put up with everything. But in the middle of May, on I think the second Saturday in May, they suddenly in all 12 provincial headquarters and Kaduna. They upped houses, got those matchets, and they had a thing called langa langa, which is a long sheet of sharp steel that normally you bound round and nailed into pen cases to make them thief-proof. And with those, that kind of weapon and baseball bats, they went to what's called the Sabongeri. Every Nigerian town had a kind of corrugated iron shanty town beside it called the Sabongeri, the new town, where all the Igbos lived. And they slaughtered every single adult male. That would be about 12th of May 1966. Every single, and they, to my astonishment, didn't touch a single wife or child. And there was a change in the atmosphere. The messengers, who up till then had been politely respectful, I only had to send in an adverse report and they could lose an increment or even lose their jobs, they suddenly started getting truculent. And they'd forgotten that staying still in Nigeria were people who could speak Hausa. Mostly after 6 years of self-government, most of the Hausa speakers had gone, and commercial firms and departments had brought in anybody who was capable of doing the job, who just had to use English and hope, and usually a Nigerian gang foreman or executive officer would be able to understand and translate to the rest. But there were just a few people who could speak Hausa, and they were forgetting that, and they said cheerfully, within my hearing, unaware that I was A, able to hear, and B, able to understand, "Sana and my dakata tarokemo." And then the Igbo's wife prostrated herself onto the ground and begged us, "Ama munki, munkashi shidukta haka, kabanta." But she begged us, but we refused. We beat her husband to death in front of her just the same. And then they said things like, they'd of course pillaged and vandalized and robbed what they could lay their hands on in the Igbo Sabongeri. And they said to my, and this caused a chill in me, "Kozami Congo Gabantarawa. Do you think we can get away with doing the same to the Europeans like the Africans did to the Belgians in Belgian Congo in last year?" And oh no, it was about 5 or 6 years ago. And the reply was, "Akai hankari, ama kai hankari, tarawa sunadasa'a." We better not try that for the moment. The Europeans might have a trick or so up their sleeve. So that was messengers who'd spent 19 years of my service being polite, deferential, and jumping to my command, and they were saying things like that. And then that night, a lot of houses called applicants. An applicant, there are a lot of primary schools in Nigeria. We'd spent a lot of development money opening and running primary schools, building and so on, but we never have the money for a secondary school, which needed things like science laboratories and so on, and better qualified staff, because better qualified staff demanded higher salaries. So hundreds of thousands of northern Nigerians in the primary schools reached what was called Standard 7, and that was roughly about the intelligence you might expect from a pass at 11 plus. There they were, 15 years old, with a Standard 7 certificate and no job. If you couldn't get to a secondary school, you hadn't got any skills in this modern world to offer to get a job. And they were not going to go back to their native farms and slug away as peasant farmers. So there are thousands and thousands of them called generally applicants, meaning that they applied the whole time for jobs and never got one. And they were going around. They came to my place and they dragged out. We had a rather old, 50-year-old, not very satisfactory ayah, and looking after the children, ayah, ama, nurse. She was a Igbo, a bit past her best, but what was competition from Americans and others who had flooded into Nigeria following self-government? That was the best we could manage. And they beat her about, and I grabbed something, I think, a coffee table or something, and rushed out at them and threatened them. And they turned on me and said, "Kazo Mugani, you come, we shall see." And to my shame, I just didn't charge them or try and beat them. Five or six of them, and aged about 16, and they had matchets and clubs and things. And but at least at that point, they then left the IRA, and I managed to get her back into a quarter. And she was bruised, but accepted it philosophically. And Angela took risks. There was the revolutionary government had dismissed all Nigerian ministers, and all their houses were emptied. So we used them for a collecting point for Igbos, many of whom were injured, who were still alive, and tried to get them back down to their own country, eastern Nigeria. But it was difficult. The revolutionary military had sealed off each of the three roads out of Kaduna. You only needed a section of 10 men armed to do that. They also controlled the airport and the railway station. But gradually we managed to get them away, mostly by rail. But the Igbos were awful. One Igbo arrived absolutely chock-a-block with his personal effects and was told, no personal effects, you just got to get aboard with whatever you stand up in, and we'll get as many of you back to safety in East Nigeria as possible. The moment he reached Enugu Airport in safety, he sent a telegram and issued a writ against the British officer who told him to leave his stuff behind, claiming, you know, that they're saying he would sue for the value of the stuff and get it out of that British officer's salary. Another, we got him aboard a train. He was only a clerk, and instead of getting down to safety, he was back at the office next morning, taking a tremendous risk. From the northerners, saying, "You never done pay me my arrears. I have a